Let's start what we have come into the room to do. Right on. Here goes. One, two, three.
Welcome to WCBN's really wacky show, It's Hot In Here. We've got the environmental talk and music show coming up for you, Ann Arbor and the world. You are at 88.3 and you are having an hour coming up of talk about spending, consumption, hoarding, spendthrifts, tightwads. We got it all for the holiday season, so stay tuned.
My mother called me to her side. She said, son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride. And then she said, just because you become a young man now, there's still some things that you don't understand now. Before you ask some girl for a hand now, keep your freedom for as long as you can now. My mama told me, you better shop around.
All right, we are back with It's Hot In Here, the environmental music and talk show on 88.3. This is Rebecca Harden from the School of Natural Resources and Environment, and I am here with your frequent host, Kat Superfisky.
That's right, holding it down.
Holding it down for Jennifer Johnson, who's back from Uganda, not too far away, but not on air with us today. So we're going to hold it down with two guests. Two people with very different expertise about shopping, spending, consumption, and just stuff. How people get it, why they want it, what they do with it, what they're willing to do for it. It's going to be a great show. We have Stephanie Preston with background in cognitive science, neuroscience, behavior studies. She's from the Department of Psychology. Hello and welcome, Stephanie.
Hello, how are you all doing today?
Really happy. And we've got Scott Rick, who's at the Ross School. He's a professor of marketing who specializes, I'm told, in both spendthrifts and tightwads. What makes them tick? How do they work the way they do? And other money-related and stuff-related questions. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. Of course, before we dive into all this fabulous stuff we're going to learn today from Scott and Stephanie, we do have our regular features. We're going to do a brief moment of thinking about what's in the environmental news around us this week, and we're going to hear a little bit about what's in season As you know, that gets harder and harder the colder it gets outside. But we've got more than catnip to talk about today. I'm going to start with a little bit of environmental news and thinking about what's going on in that.
Yeah, so one of the first things that I heard this morning when I woke up was about the snowstorms ripping across the Southwest in the U.S. And, you know, normally I'd be like, oh, that's too bad, so sad for those folks. Get used to it, get a down parka, and the rest of us put up with it the majority of the winter. But this time it's a little bit different. I'm actually planning a road trip from Michigan all the way out to L.A. To move someone out there over my break. And I specifically chose states like Kansas, New Mexico, Texas, Arizona, and then out to California because I figured I would be avoiding that snow. Not wanting to go through Colorado and Utah because usually, you know, it's pretty intermittent snow or all the time snow. So I woke up this morning and was like, oh, rats, because I'm leaving on Friday. So right now they're scheduled to say that about 15 to 20 inches of snow could be falling on those states down there in the Southwest and in the Great Plains. Supposedly it's stopping by tomorrow. So I'm hoping that the road closures will not be that big of a deal by the end of the week. But I mean, I'm going to haul some butt across to Kansas and hopefully be there by Friday night. So I hope that they get their stuff figured out by then.
Good luck with that. You know, I grew up in Tennessee, and in states that don't get the kind of snow regularly, people don't know what to do.
I know.
People are all at the supermarket hoarding Wonder Bread and canned goods, and they're closing everything because it's like, you know, so that's the fear, right, is there'll be some shutdown.
So I have a feeling that I'll probably be like stuck in a dirty motel room in Kansas City, Kansas for, you know, the majority of my break. And for, you know, Christmas Eve and, you know, Christmas and maybe even New Year's, who knows? I'll take a nice shovel and scrape my way there. But that's my big environmental news.
Well, good luck with that, Kat. I feel for you. I feel for you. But I feel like we're sending out the best we have onto that snow frontier.
Sunny vibes to melt it all away.
If you can't do it, nobody can, Kat. You go. You go. All right. Well, that's all the environmental news I think I have the stomach for this morning. I can't even imagine confronting that wall of snow.
Nope.
So I want to maybe cheer myself up with a little more music before we head into what's in season. What do you think about that, Kat?
I think that sounds...
What do you want to hear?
Amazing.
What do you want to spin for people? What are we going to do?
Oh, my gosh.
So many good options.
Can we shake it up a little bit?
Let's shake it up.
Why don't we do Notorious B.I.G.?
Love that.
Yeah?
Okay.
A little more money, more problems.
That's so
true. Let's get people rocking early on.
So true.
Get excited, people. We're talking consumerism around the holidays.
Let's do it.
Now, who's hot, who's not? Tell me who rock, who sell out in the stores. You tell me who flop, who cop the blue drop, who jewels got popped, who mostly don't get down to the jewel drop. The same old pimp, Mace, you know ain't nothing changed but my limp. Can't stop till I see my name on a blimp. Guarantee a million sales for the love of luck. You don't believe I'm all in world, double up. We don't play around, it's a bet, lay it down. Niggas didn't know me 91, bet they know me now. I'm the young Harlem with the Goldie sound. Can't no PD, hold me down. Cooler, school me to the game, now I know my duty. Stay humble, stay low, blow like Hootie. True pimp, spin no dough on the booty. Yeah, there go Mace, there go your cutie. See me die, then see me fly. I call all the shots, rip all the spots, rock all the rocks, top all the drops. I know you're thinking now when all the ball is stopped. You never home, gotta call me on the yacht. 10 years from now, we'll still be on top. Yo, I thought I told you that we won't stop. Now what you gonna do with a crew that got money much longer than yours? And a team much stronger than yours. Violate me, this will be your day. We don't play, mess around, be on your way, cause it ain't enough time here, ain't enough lime here for you to shine here, deal with many women but treat down fair, and I'm bigger than the city lights down in Times Square, yeah, yeah, yeah.
No info for the DEA. federal agents mad cause I'm flagrant. Tap myself and the phone in the basement. My team supreme, stay clean. Triple beam, miracle dream. I'll be that. Catch a seat at all events bent. Send holsters, girls on shoulders. Playboy, I told ya. Me and Mike to me, bruise too much. I lose too much. Step on stage, the girls boo too much. I guess it's cause you run with lame dudes too much. Me lose my touch, never that. If I did, ain't no problem to get the where the true players at. Throw your rollies in the sky, waving side to side, and keep your hands high while I give your girl an eye. Player please, lyrically, you can see B.I.G. be flossing, jig on the cover of Fortune, 500. Hit my phone number, your man, they got to know. I got the dough, got the flow down, piss at platinum plus, like this at dangerous on Trisac, leave your ass piss at.
Across, the more problems we see. Oh. Oops, we're on the air. Kat, what's in season?
Oh, a lot of good stuff.
I don't
other
know.
Other than catnip eggs.
Of the season for
Latkes. Guys. Latkes. Latkes are in season. I ate them last night for dinner.
I ate them last week with my discussion sections.
And how did that work?
They made them.
I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Classic potato latkes, or
yeah, they made them with what else did they use? And they did homemade applesauce on top.
I did homemade applesauce
too. Did you
too.
Really? Let's hear more about it.
Well, I was cooking with Joe Trumpy, who's going to be on the show, I hope, this winter.
Yes.
He and his wife Shelley and his two girls, who live in a straw bale house out near Clear Lake, Grass Lake, off the grid, gorgeous off the grid lifestyle. So of course they're like, "Did you grow these apples?" I was like, "No." I did not, but I did make the applesauce with apples from the farmer's market, okay? So it was pretty good.
It's a step closer.
Had a little clove and cinnamon in the applesauce.
Oh,
cook it down
nice.
With just a little water, not too shabby. And then we had creme fraiche instead of sour cream.
Wow.
And the latkes, get this, we made them with beets and carrots and white potatoes. So we grated like the beets and carrots and white potatoes and mixed them together.
Was it like a pretty even ratio of all three of those?
Yeah, one third. Maybe even a little, yeah, about even, I think.
Huh.
A little egg, little flour. Fantastic combination.
Wow. Now, last week was my first experience with latkes, actually. And so it was just.
Are you kidding?
No.
I'm so sorry.
I know. And I'm spilling it on air to everyone, too.
Yeah.
You are. Here's my confession.
Okay.
I haven't had a latke until last week.
Thought you were more worldly than that, Kat.
I know, right? But they were all, it was all comprised of potato, but they were still really
They're
tasty.
They're so good. They're yeah. so good. And really just nice for the holidays. Really, really nice for the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a little work, you know, grating everything, putting it all together.
Not bad,
but
yeah.
Then really delicious.
That's why I was glad that I just had the students make it for me. They brought it in, and I was like, A plus all around.
I recommend
that. That's not how I give out my grades.
No, not at all. Not at all. No, and I will say, people got out of the house yesterday in our yard. It was kind of a nice afternoon, and we got a lot of questions. They were like, "Why is your yard filled with straw?" And I said, "Well, actually, under the straw are these garden beds that we had put in by our SNRE alumni, Mike Levine."
Nice.
Right? Nature and Nurture came mm-hmm. over with Erica, and they put in some beds instead of lawns. And we have the last of the collard greens and the kale in season right now. So we put a little straw on top so they don't get too much snow. And we just went in there yesterday and picked a bunch and shredded them up and sautéed them. Fantastic.
What a good time for kale.
Vegetarian
for all those, like, brassicas.
You got it. So that's what's in season in my house. Latkes with beets and collard and kale.
Yep. That sounds wonderful.
I think it's beyond my house, though. I mean, Stephanie came in here to the studio earlier, and she said that she saw some stuff online about Whole Foods. And what are they doing? What are they doing, Stephanie?
Yeah, I was on the internet this morning signing up for my tennis class, and I noticed they have also Rec and Ed classes for cooking sponsored by Whole Foods, and one of them is on cooking with winter vegetables. That sounded like very promising.
Very promising.
Yeah. Now, is that like a is that a series of classes or just a one time shop where you go in once?
On Reckon Ed, you sign up for individual evenings.
Okay.
Depending on what you want to learn. I signed up for a couple Indian cooking evenings.
Nice.
So you can just kind of pick and choose what you're interested in.
Awesome.
Winter vegetables. Sounds fantastic. But let's not dwell too much on winter vegetables. I want to ask Stephanie other questions.
Yeah, let's get down to it.
Let's get into it. I mean, you know, people are buying more than beets this time of year.
What's more interesting than winter vegetables, though, really?
Well, you know me. I could go on and on about them.
Me too, honestly. But consumption is fascinating as well, especially in the society that we live in.
Actually, I have to say, I think of Stephanie's work a lot because our yard, the same one with the collard greens and the kale, has a ton of black walnut trees. And so this fall, the squirrels have been out of control with the walnuts. Have you been seeing this in our neighborhood, Stephanie, out by the Arboretum?
Yeah, and I especially noticed Burns Park is lousy with squirrels. There's my daughter and I walked through Burns Park the other day, and she counted 25 just in the yards through over a couple blocks.
Yeah, we're covered. We're inundated.
It's been a bumper crop for the squirrels this year, and they've been so happy. And everywhere I go, I hear them, that little sound when they're having a snack on the black walnuts, and you're like, what's that squeaky teeth
on a nut? I've
got one
outside of my balcony, and he just sits there all the time, and the black walnut goes and like scrapes the teeth on the
shell. Am I just on drugs, Stephanie, or did some part of your research evolve out of animal behavior with like hoarding stuff and storing stuff? And can you tell me? I feel like there's a part of your past history
that links that
to what humans do with like food and stuff. Am I crazy?
No, you're not crazy. I actually have a PhD in animal food storing, which is one of the few people on the planet probably who studied animal food storing. So I did research on kangaroo rats, which are desert adapted animals that store seeds, and I also did some studies on the campus squirrels on the Berkeley campus.
Oh my gosh.
How they make decisions to store nuts and where to put them and how much time and energy to invest based on the quality of the nut, the lipid content, the weight, the survivability throughout the year.
How did the field methods on the Berkeley squirrel study work? I mean, were you like out there as a graduate student, like on the campus half your time following squirrels around? And did you get some flack from your colleagues and friends about that? Or really, how did that work?
It is a little unusual, I suppose, but we were already known as the crazy food storing ladies, so that wasn't too surprising to my peers. Well, my advisor and the other graduate students in the lab. So they were used to us, but Berkeley, as you can imagine, had a lot of people already feeding the campus squirrels. So it wasn't really, we didn't have to train them or habituate them. They were all perfectly willing to come up and receive a nut. So I would go out at the same time every day and one nut at a time, you know, give it to them. And we dyed them with hair dye, kind of like an ecological hair dye that we shot out of water guns to mark them so we could tell the individuals apart. And then you trace the individual over time, what they do with the nuts. And
awesome.
I did
that
actually.
So cool.
It was fun.
How come you haven't done any of that here on the Diag, Stephanie? I think it would be a lot of fun.
On my way here, actually, to the station, I walked past two girls who were sitting kind of outside of Angel Hall, and they literally had a fleet of squirrels around them climbing into their laps. And they were tossing out some peanuts to them.
No spray guns full of dye?
No spray guns full
of
dye. So there's
shame.
No followers yet. Yeah. But we could get this trend happening on our campus, too.
They actually have a Michigan squirrel club.
Yeah, they do.
That meets at routine intervals on Sundays to feed the Diag squirrels. And I did look into doing the research on the Diag, but there's a specific behavior I studied where the squirrels flick their head after they put the nut in their mouth, and we try to discern whether it's a behavior to measure the weight of the nut in order to make decisions about where to cache. And only some of the squirrels on campus do it, not all of them. And so it was a little harder to elicit the main behavior that we were studying on this campus.
Are you saying almost all of the Berkeley squirrels gave the flick of the head and only half of the Michigan squirrels do?
I think it's like a year. I just got a big nut.
Actually, the one that I did find routinely doing it was on the president's lawn. So maybe it's a sign of, you know, expertise and excellence in a squirrel.
Status cache.
Needs to spread.
Status cache. gosh, I love it.
The meme totally hasn't spread yet fully to the campus here.
No, but really, I have to ask you how in the world you got from that to working on, because now your work is not so much about squirrels, it's about people and how That's people right. deal with behavior regarding possessions and decisions, the interface of emotions and decisions in consumption. I mean, unpack that. How did you get from dying squirrels to...
Right. Well, my research was actually on the role of emotion in making the decisions about how to cache the nuts. So I studied stress as a proximate mediator to decide to store nuts. Hmm. So how do you decide to store nuts? Storing happens when animals are hungry or they're stressed by environmental conditions, like in the desert, adapted animals. So I thought stress could be a proximate signal to the body that you need to conserve resources and store the food. And so because I'm interested in physiology, we did some studies with natural stressors in the lab, but really the next phase involves decapitating animals, which I wasn't so keen on.
I hear you.
And right around that time, they invented fMRI, so you can study the brains of humans without decapitating them.
And also I, good.
That was a handy revolution in human science. So I looked for a postdoc.
fMRI?
It's functional magnetic neuroimaging, where you can take brain scans of people in like a CT or fMRI scanner, but it shows the activity of the brain in the different regions depending on the task they're doing in the scanner at the time.
Oh, right. So these are the studies of like who defers gratification and who doesn't and what part of the brain responds to a certain kind of stimulus,
right,
et cetera, incentive studies and
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah. So in my studies or in some of Scott Rick's studies, we can put people in the scanner and give them stimuli like shopping-related materials or items that humans naturally amass in their homes, which is like a larder hoard, the same that an animal stores food. People store food in their pantry. They store money in their bank accounts. So we measure this as a hoarding behavior.
Oh my gosh.
And so then you could see like parts of their brain flare up on this scan.
That's right. Yeah.
So if they hoard more, there's more flare or what? Like,
like what do you see?
Well,
what are you looking for?
It's complicated, but you're trying to look for differences, for example, in the brains of people who excessively hoard, mm-hmm. who do it like compulsive hoarders mm-hmm. that you see on TV, versus people who we call Spartans, who don't like to amass goods. What is the difference in their brain activity and reported emotion when they view these items?
And what are you finding? Anything? Can't be disclosed yet.
Well, we've
read the book.
A couple of interesting things. One is there's an area in the orbital frontal cortex, which is like right kind of behind your eyeballs, near your forehead. That's involved in decision making and influenced by emotion. And this is involved for all types of decision making tasks, including for just mundane material goods. So things like toilet paper and toothbrushes and mm-hmm. hairbrushes, the kinds of things we all buy at CVS and have in our homes, is also influenced during decision processes by this prefrontal region that has a lot of interconnections with emotional regions. And we also have one interesting finding that people who have more hoarding behavior in their real life, more compulsive hoarding, they have activity in this kind of reward center of the brain when they view these common goods. So perhaps to them, these more mundane items have incentive salience the way like a drug or a cupcake or a lot of money would have to an average person.
Wow. So then where do you draw the line between someone who you would technically call a hoarder and someone you'd call a planner? Because I would say, oh, yeah, you know, I always make sure that my, you know, cupboards are stocked, that my toiletries are taken care of so I don't run out of toothpaste or TP while I'm, you know, on the toilet or something like that. But I would consider myself, I'm responsible. I'm planning ahead. I'm stocking my shelves and things like that. So where do you draw the line between people who, I mean, is every kind of behavior like that considered hoarding, or does it have to get to some sort of a threshold?
That's a really good question and something that most people wonder about, because when I bring this up, they think I'm calling them a hoarder and then they get nervous. And
I'm sweating.
Yeah.
And that's not the case at all. So our contribution to the literature is to take this term hoarding, which is currently mostly applied to clinical cases and not considered a normal adaptive behavior, mm-hmm. and demonstrate that it is a normal adaptive behavior that has normal individual differences in the population. So people vary along this continuum, only at one extreme is it compulsive hoarding. And also other features are required before it would be considered problematic, like it causes distress to you and your family. It impedes normal daily functioning. So there's like questions that have to be crossed that a normal planner wouldn't exceed.
Huh.
Wow.
So we all have to come to terms with the fact that we are all hoarders.
Yeah.
It's a natural behavior.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about it.
I'm a hoarder.
I have to say, it really reminds me of the next song up that I wanted to play for our audience today, because it's a really nice anthem from Erykah Badu. Bag Lady, you
yes,
know it?
So good.
It's right on topic. And before we move into more on emotion, decision, consumption, talking across, you know, Scott's expert base and Steph's expert base, let's listen to Erykah Badu's expertise on this.
I think that sounds great.
Pretty relevant. Please. Wow. Welcome back to WCVN-FM Ann Arbor, 88.3 on your FM dial. We're here today with It's Hot in Here, that environmental talk show with lots of tunes. And we are bringing you thoughts and comments from both Scott Rick and Stephanie Preston, both scientists at the University of Michigan who study very different aspects of consumption and human behavior with stuff and money. So we thought that would be a nice show for the holiday season, and Stephanie was just talking with us about her previous work. Wanted to ask her about her upcoming work and current projects. I know you were involved in running a big Michigan meeting about the science of consumption, the interdisciplinary science of consumption. Was that last year or?
Yeah, that was in 2010. We had a grant from the university to host a conference on the interdisciplinary science of consumption. It was a great meeting. We had speakers from all over the world. And I think it was a great success. So we were looking to expand it into maybe a regular event. So starting this coming March 23rd to 24th, we're going to have another meeting. It'll probably be held in East Hall, but we'll have announcements out at consumption.umich.edu. And Scott Rick, who's here today, is helping co-organize it, and he'll be giving a talk on his work. We also have talks from economists, neuroeconomists, developmental psychology, marketing, judgment, decision making, a foraging and food science person. So it should be another exciting one.
Very cool. Scott, what are you going to talk about for the conference?
Well, I'll be talking about some of my work on spending and saving. So I try to look at the psychology underlying that. Part of it has been with fMRI. So we did a study where people were shopping while having their brains scanned. And it was real money and real goods, so they were motivated to kind of pay attention and take it seriously. And among other things that we found was this relationship between a brain region known as the insula. It's this little prune-sized region. It's active typically when we're distressed, if we're rejected socially, or somebody is unfair to us, or maybe we smell something distressing. The more this region was active, once we showed people the price, once we showed people the price, the more this region was active, the less likely they were to spend. So it seemed as if they were relying on distress to help control their spending behavior.
Oh my gosh.
So like a high price would make the thing go out of control.
And the thing
so
is called
wouldn't.
The insula, you said.
The insula.
Yes.
Like, what? It costs that much? Forget it.
Yes.
But what about the people who get really turned on by things like status symbols, and that they'd want to spend a lot of money in order to show people that they have Louis Vuitton pumps and things like that?
Yeah. So we told people that these were deeply discounted prices, so that the amount of information you can take away from a price is kind of diminished in this setting. So normally, yeah, a high price might indicate that this is a very sought after good, maybe a status signal. That information was a bit muted in our study. So they knew they were discounted. And
so they were reacting to it not being the discount they thought it might be, or something along those lines.
There could have been some disappointment there. Maybe they thought it was still unfairly high. But it did seem to suggest that kind of psychological distress were kind of like the brakes on the car. We did see kind of normal appetitive responses. So the regions that are kind of dopamine targets, those would be very active when the good was attractive to them. But there was this competing activation in this pain region.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So here's the question to both of you guys. I guess how much do marketing professionals, how much do the people making the products and trying to sell the products think about this kind of, or I should say know about this kind of stuff, like the inner workings of the brain, and really utilize it to make sure that they get their product to sell?
Well, I will say that there doesn't seem to be a buy button, which you often hear about. There's using the brain data helped us predict what they would purchase, but if we just asked them survey measures, that did pretty well too. So there's no like buy button. But I will say that marketers seem to be keenly aware of this phenomenon, which has been called the pain of paying. And they a lot of what we're doing is almost reverse engineering what you already see out in the marketplace. So spending with credit, for example, is less painful than forking over cash, because you're just swiping a card. There's nothing physically leaving your possession. So that's why that's why they want to encourage credit. And that's why you're starting to see these on keychains, where you can just wave a keychain and pay for it that way. trying to make it less tangible and more abstract, the payment.
They also have a really burgeoning field of neuromarketing where they're trying very desperately to use brain imaging to help sell products and improve them. Like, instead of having a focus group, you would stick a couple people on the scanner, and you probably heard about this. Yeah, during the presidential elections, I think you must have read about them doing this for people previewing candidates and things like that.
Yeah, companies like Neurofocus, they're charging kind of a ransom, a king's ransom, to do these studies. Often, I think a lot of these answers could be resolved with surveys, self-reports, but it just feels more real if you see that brain image. There's a paper about the seductive allure of neuroscience explanations, that once you get this bit of brain information, it kind of shuts off your own rational processing and you just accept whatever you hear next. So there is a powerful placebo effect.
Yeah, I'll never forget when I was at Harvard in my postdoctoral years, and I remember seeing a talk by a scholar on some of the early generation frontal lobe studies, responses to incentives and deferred gratification stuff, and who, you know, how people. And I remember someone in the room stood up and said, "Okay, so could you just tell me how this is any different or better than what Freud already told us about id and ego?" Like, haven't there been some brilliant minds in the history of social theory who already figured this out? Well, we're just putting colors to it and we're locating it like anatomically. But is there anything really new here that we just never even imagined? And I have to say, that's an interesting question. I guess the combination of the two would be a really powerful way to formulate questions about this stuff.
Yeah, I think it's all about triangulating using different methods. fMRI provides some evidence. It's correlational. We know when they're indicating their decision, for example. We don't know really when they make the decision. Mm-hmm. In our shopping study, they could see the product and say, I don't want this. And then 8 seconds later, they actually say that. So, but if you combine that with more experimental methods, give people drugs to actually affect these brain regions, find people with lesions in these regions, and then tape those things together, then I think you're really onto something.
Oh my goodness, that sounds involved. I have to ask, Scott, how or whether in your own, I mean, you teach marketing courses here on campus at the Ross School, and I wonder how much your research kind of is a parallel track for you or informs or draws from your teaching at all.
Yeah, I think my research very much informs my teaching, which is a challenge because I teach the marketing core class for undergraduates. But I do find ways to make a lot of it relevant. So I find vice versa as well. Ideas generated in the class kind of remind me of things. Oh, I need to look at this topic.
How about you, Stephanie? Do you find that the research can sort of be an infusion into your teaching and vice versa? Or is it sort of a separate piece of your career that has a kind of a parallel track?
I think in the big picture that they influence one another, not specifically about hoarding or something per se, but in the way you think about people's nervous system and their brains have certain predispositions that you want to work for and not against. So, for example, certain kinds of assignments are going to be lower bars or met with more smiles than other types of assignments, depending on people's predispositions and what they are interested in.
Really fascinating stuff, I have to say. And then I am thinking about what I want to do is take this conversation a little bit into what happens when you're spending not for yourself, but for someone else. We are in the middle of the holiday season here, and think a little bit creatively about some of the broader possibilities for that. And then also social concerns about consumption behavior in the aggregate and how the individual, you know, puzzle pieces you're looking at add up or don't in your own minds. But before we get to those levels of kind of the holiday, the ritual, the spending, the future, what all this has to do with sustainability, I wonder if we could listen to some more music, because we've got some great tracks lined up. And I know one of them is one that I grew up with. It's a really fun Take the Money and Run. I don't know if we got that queued up, but I got to just hear that before we go on, because this is just too heavy to keep talking and talking without breaking it up.
This is a story about Billy Joe and Bobby Sue. Get high and watch it too. And here's what happened when they decided to cut loose. They headed down.
taxes. He ain't gonna let those two escape justice. He makes his living off of the people's taxes. By two, whoa, she slipped away. Billy Joe caught up to her the very next day.
And we're back. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ann Arbor. You are listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Every other week from noon to one, you can catch us here at It's Hot in Here Radio talking all about the environment and also kicking it up with some groovy tunes like the one you just heard there from Steve Miller Band. What a classic.
Oh, Take the Money and Run.
And that was actually a request, right?
Yeah. That was a request from one of our guests today, Scott Reck.
Great, great music.
Spinning some tunes that are a nice, nice soundtrack for talking about people and money.
Mm-hmm.
And spending. And Scott
is the season.
Scott is a marketing professor at the Ross School here at University of Michigan, and he's been really doing some work to flesh out the characteristics of the spendthrift versus and the tightwad. Am I right?
Yeah, that's right. The brain study I mentioned earlier, where we found some physical evidence for a pain of paying, got us thinking about whether this is something that differs chronically across people, whether some feel it very intensely and often and others maybe don't feel it enough. And
the pain of paying. I love it.
And we do think of it as a psychological distress. It's not like getting hit in the face, but it's more anxiety or worked up. And so we developed a scale, and it does seem to we call it the tightwad spendthrift scale. And we do find that there are a lot of tightwads out there. You hear about the spendthrifts, but there are a lot of people frustrated with how little they spend. They have big bank accounts, but it's not because they were planning on saving money. It's just kind of left over from frustrating episodes where they can't indulge. Spendthrifts have the opposite problem. They don't have enough distress when it's time to spend money. So they spend a lot of it, and they're unhappy with that as well. And then there are a lot of people in the middle who we call unconflicted, and they're less interesting because they're happy and well-adjusted and
financially
don't study them.
Viable.
Boring.
Yes.
What about you get the two of those together? It must be like fireworks,
yeah.
Right? What do we know about that?
So typically the finding is that birds of a feather flock together. We basically go out, at least when it comes to romantic relationships, we go out and we marry ourselves. So somebody who's similar on all kinds of dimensions, but it had been proposed that, hey, if there's something you don't like about yourself, maybe you don't go out and look for that.
Paula Abdul actually was the one who spearheaded that with the Opposites Attract song back in the, what was it, the early 90s?
No, I have that cassette.
She was the one that spearheaded that campaign.
I love that you have that cassette.
But, so we thought that...
We can cue that one up, too.
So we thought that the Abdul prediction was kind of custom made for our own reasoning about tightwads and spendthrifts. So we went out and looked for it, and indeed we found that tightwads and spendthrifts tend to marry each other. And
really?
It's a very rare instance where opposites consistently attract. But we call it fatal fiscal attraction because this seems to be bad news, that the more they're different on this dimension, the more they fight over money. The less happy they are with the marriage, they wish they married somebody else. And this is even controlling for how much money they have, how much debt they have. So a spendthrift, does better off financially by marrying a tightwad, but they're happier in debt with another spendthrift.
Yeah, I almost feel like it would be kind of like that, a good fling to have with the, you know, the opposite of like, oh yeah, this is like a fun, like, you know, summer or like weekend getaway or something. But then when it really comes down to it, I feel like, yeah, I could see where you'd want to be with somebody who had the exact same kind of, or at least similar kind of spending habits to you.
Well, so what do we think about this in the holiday season? It's got to be a nightmare if you've got the shopping list and one of you has got these generous, impulsive behaviors like, oh, I know little Nikki would love that. Are you kidding me? You're going to spend that on Nikki? Like, how does that work?
What That's where divorces happen.
Yeah, well, maybe. Or at least, I don't know, kind of a snarky holiday season.
Yeah.
Do we see? And I don't know, Scott and Stephanie, what the differences are, because a lot of the research that the two of you have talked about today is about individuals presumably spending for themselves or their own households. And I don't know what the, you know, gift buying and sort of ritual exchange element of the holidays does to all these impulses. Do we know anything about that yet? Or what's it look like?
I was just going to mention one finding we have, and then I wanted to ask Scott a question where somebody else had proposed, well, maybe compulsive hoarders are actually sort of miserly, you know, like the Ebenezer Scrooge character, and they're hoarding and they're keeping and they're greedy and selfish. Mm-hmm. So we did a little test of this, and we did some survey research on how much money people spend and how much they donate to charities, how many gifts they give to others. And compulsive hoarders actually donate the same amount to charities, but they give significantly more to others in gifts. And when you have, I don't know if you've ever seen like these hoarding shows, but they're always saying, no, I have to keep this to give to so-and-so, and this I'm saving for my daughter, and these are a trunk full of gifts I bought for people because they were on sale, but I haven't actually given them to them. So there seems to be some pro-social drive in there. It's just not efficiently managed. So we're interested in following up on that. But I had a question for Scott, what he would think. There's an economist, Thaler, who in mental accounting proposed that, for example, you could buy an expensive sweater and give it as a gift, and you'd be happy to receive an expensive sweater as a gift, even if you wouldn't buy it for yourself. So would a tightwad be happy to receive the expensive sweater or be upset?
Yeah, how do we shop for the tightwads and the spendthrifts on our list this year? What are your tips?
We know how to shop
for
the spendthrifts.
Let's give out some good advice here.
Yeah.
Any tips?
No, it's a good question, because I think, and I'm just starting to look at this, that tightwads actually do like goods a little less than spendthrifts like goods. So I think they'd still be flattered by it, but they like it less, and they find spending more painful, and these seem to be separate drivers of their tendencies. I do think they would still be happy, but perhaps not as happy as the spendthrift, who, even though they would have bought it themselves the next day at the after Christmas sale.
Right.
But we do find that spending differences between tightwads and spendthrifts do go away a bit when it comes to gift giving. Maybe it's less painful to pay for other, you know, buy something for somebody else. Maybe it's just more mandatory. You have to have something under the tree for these
right.
people. There's a
right.
relationship gun to your head, but...
Says
what,
the man.
Well,
ho, 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 everybody.
Yeah. Merry Christmas.
No, it's the gun that keeps this economy going, I might add, right? I mean, you know, this
and
whole
my economy. Relationship.
Well, we'll see after this broadcast.
We are live, ladies and gentlemen. There's no turning back.
Right. But so in a sense, then, the holiday season does potentially smooth out some of those conflicts temporarily, at least, and provide a little more flow in the economy and in the household economy around these issues. That's interesting to think about.
I was thinking of Rebecca this morning. I think this gift giving ritual, it's so generous, but also creates a lot of stress for people. And I think in the holiday times, we have to actively manage our generosity and our fear of being judged and the stress that the holidays bring.
I was just going to bring that up in terms of I'm not a big fan of programmed gift giving. I love being spontaneous. And when and if I find something for someone, that's when I don them with, you know, whatever it is, a new sweater or, you know, a fun card or something like that. But I really hate when it's a birthday or it's, you know, some sort of a holiday, or especially around like Christmas time and things like that, where it's prescribed that you are supposed to buy these people gifts. And I just feel like I much more appreciate spending time with the people and things like that. And then if I end up finding a cool gift for them throughout the year, giving it to them. But I definitely stressful. It would be the word that comes to mind when I think about the holiday season and having to think about purchasing things for people. Cause I have no idea.
And stressful then gets us back to your research, Steph, on how stress can then produce impulses to consume or to go to things as a solution in a way that exacerbates the stress. It's like a vicious cycle on some level.
Yeah, we actually find anxiety is the single greatest predictor of wanting to consume and store and hoard resources.
So this is like commodity fetishism. I mean, again, social theory. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff out there now. Unplug the Christmas Machine is a book that comes to mind that a lot of friends have been using to try to recalibrate their family and household practices and rituals and their kids' expectations. I mean, right now on Facebook, the amount of moms and parents that are like, oh my gosh, why does this have to be so materialistic? Couldn't we just have a family walk on Christmas morning, maybe go to mass or whatever you do, you know, and just call it quits? So I think we're in a moment right now, especially with the economic downturn, where people are looking for solutions to kind of scale down the expectations and the stress and the very texture almost of the holiday, so it's a little bit less expensive and glamorous and anxiety producing. And yet we see it everywhere, this veneration of the silvery, glittery, luscious, delicious holiday. The Williams-Sonoma catalog comes in the mail. You're screwed. You know, there's no way. It's like, and the kids open up the catalog. Oh, mama, you know, so this is really tricky. Yeah.
Well, not to be a Debbie Downer about the materialistic stuff, but there is research coming out now on what makes the right gift. It turns out that cash does pretty well if it's framed the right way. And also just getting people what they ask for is better than getting them something unexpected. They're more satisfied, even if you take all the fun
out
of it.
Boring.
What a Debbie Downer. What a Debbie Downer.
I want this. And then somebody else just goes out and buys it. I feel like that's just goofy.
I totally have that intuition also, but
then you could do the money, money, money thing. Hey, speaking of which, ABBA, money, money, money. Could we just go to that?
Oh, we could, yeah. And we will.
Money.
Back at WCVN FM Ann Arbor. We're closing out It's Hot in Here today, and we want to thank our guests, Scott Rick and Stephanie Preston, who've been talking with us about the challenges in consumption and spending and relationships around this time of year. How not only are there a lot of social and economic and behavioral elements, but deeper evolutionary ones that sort of are hard for us to control about how we spend and what stuff we want and what we do. But we have had some hopeful tips about doing a little less, being aware of the anxiety, and how you can have a holiday that's a little bit saner, or at least not beat yourself up too much about it if you're just doing the best you can. I think we wanted to end on that note, which is that there are a lot of people trying to do better about not spending just to spend or giving just to give, but finding ways to pull together themselves and their families. And as kids get older, you get more opportunities for that, right? Kat was just saying
exactly.
It's easier to do.
Yep, you start realizing that it's not necessarily about the material goods, but it's also about just spending time with people. And that essentially, I guess in my eyes, and I think a lot of people's eyes, that giving a gift is a kind of a symbol of love and appreciation, and that there are many other ways to do that than just through a product or something like that. So, you know, showing that through other ways of just spending time with people and, you know, sharing yourself, I think is, at least in my opinion, the best thing to give.
Hear, hear.
Absolutely. Well, thanks very much to our guests. Good luck to all of you in finding ways to cook or make or walk or view or read things together this holiday.
Hug it out.
Give the gift of time, but enjoy your foray into spending when it just has to happen. And we're going to let you guys go this afternoon. We've got a song queued up that's going to be iconic for a lot of us this time of year.
Exactly.
And it's one that really sort of says it all, but with tongue-in-cheek, as always. Madonna knows how to do that tongue-in-cheek thing, and she knows how to be an emblem of consumption, doesn't she?
She does. And thank you so much, Shannon, our engineer, for sitting in studio today and helping us out with putting all these awesome tunes on and getting us out to you all, folks.